Thank you, ladies and gents. I'm delighted to be here in Cambridge at this Evidence Based Policing conference, and I'm very proud to introduce two pieces of work from Merseyside. Both pieces of work, I believe, are excellent. And we have Richie Carr on my left here and Chris Gibson on my right, who will be talking very shortly because they do know what they're talking about. The two pieces of work that they have done on behalf of Merseyside and policing are both particularly pertinent to the environment in Merseyside. The first one is about resource and policing dosage in relation to the nighttime economy and how we can do it differently. Merseyside, well, Liverpool outside of London is the number one tourist destination. Not many people would know that. You laugh, and it's true. You get more tourists into Merseyside, into Liverpool, than any other place outside London. You don't think of Liverpool like that, do you? Now, I could go on to a 15-minute diatribe about the beauty of Liverpool, but I won't. The nighttime economy is massive. It's busy, it eats up our resources, and we've done it the same way, and we've flooded it with policing for a long time. Chris will talk about a different approach, which is bearing fruit for us. But first, Richie will talk about the other key export of Merseyside, sadly, which is said is an organised crime. And there aren't many towns and cities around the UK and Europe and nationally, internationally, that doesn't have some sort of Scouse influence, unfortunately. Such is the reach of Merseyside criminals, which is nothing to be proud of, unlike the tourism. So a different way of doing it, and we make massive use of gang injunctions, and we need to know we are doing the right thing, and we need to try doing different things. Because we're very good at attacking organised crime. We have a very successful matrix team that does some fantastic work. But we can't stand still, and we need to know that it works. So on that note, Richie, over to you.
Good afternoon, everybody. It's a contradiction in terms in some respects, isn't it? That we, as Mr. Cook says, we have a really vibrant nighttime economy and lots of visitors into the city, so it's really important that we try and manage our gang and our gang culture really effectively. And as Mr. Cook alludes to, though, we've looked at some alternative ways that we believe are having some real difference or making a real difference in Merseyside. So, in terms of what our gang injunctions, forgive me if you know, but I'll give it a short whistle-stop tour on what gang injunctions are, certainly for overseas visitors, etc., in the audience, or overseas people who may not be familiar with them. But gang injunctions in the UK were introduced in 2012 by the Policing and Crime Act, which is dated 2009, so you can see it took a short while for it to become effective. But in Merseyside, we started to deal with gang injunctions as soon as they were brought into being in 2012. And in short, they are directed towards individuals who are either involved in or have encouraged gang-related violence or drug-dealing activity. And a key aspect of that gang injunction is to prevent that sort of activity, so prevent your firearms discharges, prevent your knife crime, prevent your criminal gang disputes that obviously bring harm to, in many cases, innocent residents, but also the individuals themselves. And one of the key aspects of the injunction is to protect those individuals from harm. And that probably brings a different way of thinking or a different way of looking at this particular problem. What it does actually, so it's a civil burden of proof, so it's an application to a magistrate's court on a balance of probability. So you may look at evidence in terms of what their offending history looks like, or what your intelligence picture looks like around these groups. But you've got to indicate that they are part of a criminal group who are causing harm within the community. And they are quite restrictive in their capacity, so they will restrict movement, association, and other generally legal activities. A breach of the injunction carries 2 years prison. It's not often that they get 2 years jail, so the consequences of breach are relatively minor, I say it for a particular point. Hopefully when you see the results of the study, that the impact, I think, is really clear to see. And considering the sanction for breach of the injunction is relatively minor, they do have what I would describe as a disproportionate impact. So when we started to look at these, the previous research, well, there's a lot of research out there, particularly by Pyrrhus et al. From 2016, that did a really comprehensive study around the relationship between offending and gangs, and showed consistently that there was that gang-related criminality and an escalation in criminality was there and associated with the groups. When you looked at the research around Gangan Junction themselves, it was very limited. And that was one of the driving forces to really look at this and see whether we could influence, not just locally, regionally, nationally, and perhaps internationally, how the Gangan Junctions are used. So having said that, anecdotal reports would suggest that they were an effective measure. And as I say, we were using these from 2012, and we would say in force that they were an effective measure, but there wasn't an evidence base to support that. So therefore, it was difficult to assess whether or not they were effective in any form of deterrence or encouragement to desist, to cause people to desist from crime. So this research sought to provide that evidence base and look at their offending histories over a period of time, which I'll come to see whether or not there was a difference in their offending before and after the injunctions. So the research questions. Quite simple in fairness. First of all, the difference in the offending volume before and after the issuance of a gang injunction. And then likewise, the associated harm to that offending, whether there was a difference before and after. And equally, the key component, I think, in terms of protecting the individuals from harm, whether or not there was a difference in the levels of victimisation suffered by those gang members before or after the issuance of the injunction. So a pen picture of the methodology, and I suppose Merseyside. Well, Merseyside's got a population of around 1.3 million people. Of that, I believe that we're really strong in terms of identifying our organised crime groups. We had, certainly when I did this in 2016, we had in the region of 190 identified organised crime groups, with around just over 2,800 members, which equates to 0.01% of the population. So when we talk around the power few, these really are a small cohort of people that are causing the disproportionate amount of harm in the community. So a really important point to target these people. So since 2012, Merseyside have acquired 75 gang injunctions that were affiliated to 9 organised crime groups. My study consisted of a longitudinal time series analysis of 50 of those individuals which were affiliated to 6 organised crime groups. The reason I took out those extra 25s because the timescales in terms of the implementation of the gang injunctions, it would have been unfair or unreasonable to make an assessment of the impact over such a short space of time. So what I was able to do was divide that group of 50 into 2 parts. The reason being that 36 gave me what I believe to be an extensive period of research. So 36 months before and 36 months after the injunctions were imposed. So 3 years of data in terms of their offending before and 3 years after. But likewise, in terms of the complete 50, I was able to gather 12 months data in terms of their offending before and after. And I would argue that that would give me an indication of the immediacy of impact. So what was the immediate outcome of an injunction being imposed on these people? So that we didn't skew our results, I made allowances for time in custody against what are arguably a very prolific group of offenders who, interestingly, before the injunctions, they spent around 6% of the time in custody. Afterwards, they spent around 14% of the time in custody. And I'll come to it through the presentation. You'll see one particular graph whereby the results may not be overly consistent with the other ones, but I'll talk you through my opinion in terms of why that may be, and I'll come back to that. So what I did then, in terms of their offending patterns and their offending history over that time scale, we attributed the crime harm index, so we gave each crime a score. And as you can well imagine, these were high harm offenders, which I'll come to. And then an intense period of data cleansing to make sure that the data was accurate, so that I believe that the results of the study stood an element of scrutiny. So we just go back to the research questions. In terms of the things I was looking to establish, it was whether there was a difference in offending, a difference in the harm, and a difference in the victimisation. So in terms of the results, first of all, looking at the raw data there, you'll see that for the entire group, over those timescales, there was 432 offending episodes before the injunctions were imposed. And afterwards, there was a total number of offending episodes of 162, so a difference of 63%, minus 63%, which I thought was a real indicator. But when you break that down in terms of the offending categories that are associated with gang-related violence, so serious violence such as homicide, attempted murder, shootings, knife crime, so that upper end of criminality. The results were equally there to be seen. So when you look at the results in terms of serious violence, that from 31 to 14, a difference of 55%. In terms of drug trafficking, a difference of 40%. But the biggest difference in terms of firearms criminality, which I thought was a whopping 87%. So beyond the injunction period, our high harm offenders were reducing the volume of firearms incidents by 87%. You can also see that our organised crime group members are committing high volume offences also. High numbers of offences. Relatively low harm, but high numbers nonetheless. So we then translate that into harm. The numbers are relative. So again, the raw data, 150,000, just over, days in terms of the crime arm index before the injunction to 46,000 after, a difference of 69%. And again, when you look at that, so if you compare that with the numbers, you'll see from the graph on the right there that the other offending, so the high volume offender, is actually bringing about relatively low levels of harm on the community. But then when you look at that in terms of the serious violence and the firearms offending, there is a significant difference. Interestingly, it can be seen that whilst this group are really high harm offenders and they commit high volume offences, the offences equate to the number of offences equate to only 19% of the overall volume. But when then you translate that into harm, the harm values associated with those small number of offences equate to 90% of the harm that these groups impose on the communities and each other. When you come back to the victimisation, I would argue that these particular people are not the ones that would ordinarily report crime to the police. So I can't hide from the fact that some of the reporting they may not report certain crime, but that's not to say that we don't find out about criminal activity. So they may have been shot, so taken to hospital. Third party reporting may bring offences of serious crime to our notice. So you may think that the reported crime associated with these is relatively low levels. So in terms of serious violence before the injunction, there were 13 offences over that 3-year period. Afterwards, there were 5. Equally, in terms of other offending, there were 17, so burglaries, or they may have been subject to a robbery or something like that. 17 offences before, while there were only 7 afterwards. Interestingly, of the 13 offences of victimisation before the injunction, 7 of them related to just 3 individuals. And to bring that into reality, they were subjects of shootings, they were subjects of stabbings. In one case, they were subjects of, an attempted murder. They were chased by a vehicle and run over. So real serious crimes. So when we bring the injunction back and the purpose of the injunction to prevent harm, I would argue that this is reduced harm that is directed towards those individuals. And certainly after the injunction, there was no evidence of repeat victimisation. So when we strip that back in terms of when we've made our allowances for time in custody, you can see from the graph though, when we look at the entire group over a 12-month period, there is a difference of 63%, even over a short time, between their offending. So the harm associated with that group, that entire group, the difference in a relatively small, short period is 63%. So we're seeing an arguably immediacy of impact beyond the point of the injunction. It's a relatively busy slide, but let me try and talk you through this. So these are the offending history of the 36 individuals for the 3 years before and 3 years after. So let me talk you through OCG1 on the top right. What's important to stress here is that this group was subject of a covert operation before the injunction. So the injunction was largely our exit strategy. So that once we conducted the covert investigation and in many terms dismantled that organised crime group, the imposition of the gang injunction on the remainder was our exit strategy. What was important to do with this is that some of the individuals are subject to long-term periods of imprisonment, so they were eliminated from the group. So arguably what you've got there, or what you can see there, are the maybe not so serious offenders within that group, and that's why I would argue that the outcome or the changes observed beyond the point of injunction are what you might describe as relatively modest. But I think you would see from the other OCGs, so 2, 3 and 4, the trajectory of the injunction, in fact, that line has moved. So in terms of OCG2, that line has moved slightly. So that should be on month 36. So what you will see is that the trajectory of harm and offending beyond the point of injunction is consistent across those other three groups and across all four. So the question is whether or not we can argue that the gang injunctions bring about an element of deterrence or desistance. I think, well, I'll let you make your mind up. I think the results are reasonably clear. So you then look at the cumulative effect. So organised crime groups 1 to 4, looking at both offending and harm. And I think you can see that beyond the point of injunction, the differences in their offending is significant. So volume across the four groups is reduced by 62%, while the associated harm over the 3 years, so 3 years before and 3 years after, the difference in harm is reduced by 70%. I believe that will be a significant outcome. You can see another interpretation as the graph moves along. So the average duration of those injunctions is two years. So when I put the timeline there in terms of duration, you can see there's an element of deterrence creeping in towards the end of the injunction period. So what we wanted to do was to try and establish whether or not there were any other influencing factors that may bring about a change in offending patterns with these particular groups. Again, it's a relatively busy slide. I haven't got a pointer, but you can see there from OCG1, which is the first one that we imposed, clearly, beyond the point of injunction, their offending starts to decline, and it's a relatively gradual decline. So the black line is a relatively low-level decline towards the expiry of the injunction, but you can see that there are modest changes in terms of OCG2s and 3s, but I think the key finding there is from OCG4 that while the other injunctions are in place against OCGs 1, 2 and 3, that when you see the green line there, the trajectory of the harm and the offending caused inflicted by OCG4 follows a very similar pattern. So we can argue that the influencing factors are somewhat eliminated to show that the gang injunction has taken a real effect across these groups. That despite injunctions being in place against OCG 1, 2 and 3, while we're still policing those groups as we normally do, the offending by OCG 4 is escalating to the point of their injunction, and then it declines in a similar way that you would see the other injunctions. So I'm not going to talk around what my formal conclusions are. I'll let you make your own mind up in terms of how you see or what you believe the effectiveness of gang injunctions are. I think it's clear to say that they do have an impact on serious and organised crime, certainly in Liverpool, around this group of people. Thank you.